Okay. My topic is form, matter, composition. That was the topic I was given, and that's the topic I'm going to try to address. I will sometimes refer to form, matter, composition as hylomorphic composition. And as I indicate on the handout, I take this to be the special sort of relation that matter and form bear to the compounds of which they are a part. There's lots of questions we could ask about form, matter, or hylomorphic composition, like how we'd understand this thing. What sort of relation is this? I've suggested it's a special sort of part-whole relation, but how exactly is it like or unlike other part-whole or mereological relations? Another question we might ask is, what sorts of things can exhibit form-matter composition? Is it a type of composition that only applies to corporeal beings, or can it somehow be extended? Does it have some sort of application, even if limited, to the incorporeal world? Finally, we can ask a kind of existential question. Why think there is any form-matter composition? That is to say, why think there are any objects composed of matter and form, much less the particular ones that Aquinas thinks there are? My plan is to motivate and explain, or to try to motivate and explain, Aquinas' answers to these questions, and to do so in a way that highlights their philosophical significance, especially from the perspective of debates in contemporary analytic metaphysics. I'm not going to spend much time talking about the debates themselves. Fortunately, Professor Gorman has identified some of the ones I'll be touching on, but I do want to try to explain Aquinas' views in a way that makes it easy to see their connection, or at least facilitates a discussion of their connection. My presentation will develop in two stages. So Aquinas' views about form-matter composition can't be understood, I think, apart from the broader hylomorphic context in which he develops them. So I want to start by sketching that broader hylomorphic context and then locating Aquinas' specific views about form-matter composition within them. So that'll be stage one. Oh, and I should say, I should warn you, my procedure in this first stage will be dogmatic or opinionated. That is to say, I'm just going to proceed by simply asserting what I take to be the proper interpretation of Aquinas' hylomorphism, ignoring the sort of detailed textual analysis that would be necessary to justify my interpretation. This is one of the few contexts in which I can imagine there being heated disputes about this, but despite the risk, I'm going to do this for two reasons. First, it will allow me to introduce with maximum clarity and economy a metaphysical theory that's not only complicated but somewhat unfamiliar. My interpretation isn't as widely known. There is a new school, Brouwer School of Thomism. But that's my first reason. The second reason is it will allow me to introduce my own preferred framework and terminology for discussing the theory. And this framework is intended as a sort of bridge to link my intended audiences or the what I thought might be the actual audiences, some people who are familiar with Aquinas, but not contemporary analytic philosophy, and vice versa. So the framework and terminology is designed to bring us together for peace and harmony. Okay, so that's stage one. After sketching what I take to be the correct interpretation of Aquinas' hylomorphism, I'll then turn to Aquinas's, or what I take to be Aquinas' chief motivation for embracing it, namely a certain theory or analysis of change. That will be stage two. And my procedure in the second stage will be much more textually based. In fact, here I'm going to try to convince you that my interpretation of Aquinas' hylomorphism more or less falls out of his views about change, or what I take them to be. Okay, so that's the plan. I want to mention one complication. The theme of this year's workshop is Aquinas on Metaphysics. The topics I'm going to discuss all fall within what contemporary philosophers, at least of an analytic bent, would regard as metaphysics, and so they fit with the theme, I think. I should warn you, though, that these topics, as you may already know, these topics don't all fall within what Aquinas himself regards as metaphysics. On the contrary, some of them, in particular the discussion of matter and form as principles of change, fall within what he regards as physics or natural philosophy, rather than metaphysics. And I've given you a kind of brief statement of what I take to be Aquinas' conceptions of these two academic disciplines on the handout. And I think that statement helps to make clear that his division of these sciences is different and much sharper than the contemporary one. So this complication, I think, is important to keep track of in some context, but I'm not going to pay much attention to it here. But I just want you to know I'm aware of it. Okay, so Aquinas' hylomorphism, stage one, or Thomistic hylomorphism. What is it? Well, the basic idea, as I've suggested, under B on the handout, is that for a certain range of objects, those objects are to be understood as, quote-unquote, hylomorphic compounds. That is, objects composed of both matter and form, or houle and morphe in Aristotle's Greek. And it's perhaps obvious from that statement that matter and form are two of the central notions of Aquinas' hylomorphism. They're the houle and the morphe. And indeed, I agree with those who say these notions for Aquinas, at least in their primary and proper sense, are correlative to one another. But I think it's important to recognize that these two notions are correlative not only with one another, but also with a further notion, namely that of a hylomorphic compound, or what I'll just often refer to as a compound for short. And hence that there are really three notions central to Aquinas' hylomorphism: matter, form, and compound. And I've given you a kind of statement of what I take these notions to be. In the first part of the presentation, I'm going to gloss over, I'm going to simplify in ways, but I'll come back and hopefully nuance some of the things I say. I take this to be a kind of Thomistic pedagogical principle. You just draw the distinctions you need until the fire comes, and then you start sharpening things up. Okay, so matter, what's that? Well, that's a being that serves as the subject or substratum for some form or property. Form, well, that's a being that's possessed by some matter, roughly in the way that a property is possessed by a substratum. And a hylomorphic compound, well, that's a being that exists in virtue of and just so long as some matter or substratum possesses a form or property. That's the basic idea. And by putting the basic idea that way, I think we can see that the three central notions of Aquinas' hylomorphism, namely matter, form, and compound, bear a striking resemblance to three notions familiar from contemporary metaphysics, namely substratum, property, and complexes of each. Now, admittedly, contemporary metaphysicians don't conceive of substrata in terms of any kind of matter. Rather, they conceive of them as particulars of a distinctive type. We were introduced to them yesterday. Bare particulars. And the contemporary notion of a property would seem not to apply to one of the types of entity that Aquinas thinks of as a form, namely individual human souls. Even so, if we focus on just the structural relations between these two sets of notions, I think the resemblance is pretty much exact. Indeed, if we set aside the complications associated with the human soul, which aren't relevant, at least for my immediate purposes, and we leave open the precise nature of the beings or entities that play the role of matter or substrata, I think we can just conceive of Aquinas' hylomorphic compounds in terms of substratum property complexes, or what are nowadays commonly called facts, or concrete states of affairs. I've given you a diagram of this on the next page, C, that's supposed to kind of illustrate this, the connections of these two sets of notions. As that diagram is intended to suggest, Aquinas conceives of matter, form, and compound as three distinct types of being, bearing two distinct types of relation to one another. That little solid arrow represents the relation that Aquinas calls inherence. That's a 1-1 relation that forms bear to the matter that serves as their subject or substratum. The dotted arrows represent the relation that Aquinas calls composition, or sometimes parthood. Or more precisely, the dotted arrows taken jointly represent composition, whereas taken individually they represent parthood. And this relation, or at least composition, is a many one relation that matter and form jointly bear to the compound of which they are the parts. And now I'm unfortunate to go back, but if you look back at B on the first page, you'll see that I've spelled out those notions of inherence and composition. I call them two further notions that sort of come along for the ride with the central ones. And I've also tried to indicate there that these two notions are tightly connected for Aquinas. As Aquinas sees it, hylomorphic composition can't occur unless matter and form are appropriately related. So, for some matter and form to compose a larger compound, they must be related in such a way that the form inheres in the matter. Okay, we're already, I think, in a position to see how Aquinas is thinking of the nature of form-matter composition, or what I've been calling hylomorphic composition. It's a special type of part-whole relation, which is to say, it's like other part-whole relations in some respects, but not others. It's clearly like other such relations, insofar as it's a many-one relation that combines distinct things into some larger complex or whole. And actually, I've included a passage where Aquinas specifically speaks of form-matter composition on this analogy from De Principiis. So there is a clear sense in which hylomorphic composition is like other part-whole relations, but it's also clearly unlike other such composition relations, insofar as the distinct things being combined aren't ordinary material parts, but something more like substrata and properties. In short, hylomorphic composition, I think, can be understood in terms of what contemporary metaphysicians often refer to as constituency, which is an attempt to distinguish this kind of part-whole relation from ordinary or other sorts. In the contemporary literature, constituency is often distinguished from other part-whole relations on the grounds that it does not, whereas they do, obey the axioms of the standard contemporary mereology. And I've put those axioms at the bottom of the page, but I won't stop and discussing it this, in part because I don't think those axioms really capture other ordinary part-whole relations. Okay, so there's at least our initial introduction to the notion of form-matter composition, so a kind of answer to that initial question, what is this sort of relation? Now I want to turn for a moment to the question, what sorts of things exhibit form-matter composition? As it turns out, Aquinas thinks there are different types of hylomorphic compound, and hence different ways in which things can be composed of matter and form. His main division of hylomorphic compounds is into material substances and accidental unities. These two types of compound are distinguished both by their matter and by their form. That is to say, by the type of being that serves as their substratum and the type of form that inheres in their matter. As the first diagram under D helps to make clear, Aquinas thinks of material substances as composed of prime matter and substantial form, whereas he thinks of accidental unities as composed of substances and accidental forms. I want to say just a word or two about each of these two types of compound. So material substances first. These are the basic building blocks of the corporeal world. Indeed, Aquinas identifies them with corporeal substances or bodies and takes them to include many of the objects familiar from common sense and experience. Not only paradigmatic living things, for example, plants, animals, and human beings, but also non-living substances, such as lumps of bronze, from which statues can be generated. Aquinas refers to the forms of which material substances are composed as substantial forms, and this is because the type of compound that results from their inherence in matter is a substance, and hence we can say that the forms themselves enter into the very nature or essence of the substances. The matter side of things is a little trickier. Aquinas refers to the matter of which material substances are composed as prime matter or primary matter in order to emphasize that it alone qualifies as matter in the strict and proper or primary sense. Some matter, as we'll see, is itself composed of matter and form, but prime matter lacks all hylomorphic composition. I myself think that doesn't mean it lacks all composition, but it definitely lacks hylomorphic composition. Indeed, it's precisely because prime matter is not itself composed of any forms or actualities that Aquinas insists that it must be conceived of as, and if this were a movie, it would be like, dun-dun-dun, being in pure potentiality, or pure potentiality for short. And to emphasize its distinctiveness, I've used the only tools at my disposal in Microsoft Draw, and that is a dotted line. If there's time at the end, I'm going to come back and say a bit more about prime matter, but I want to be sure to stop after 40 minutes, so we'll see about that. Okay, so much for material substances. Let's now turn to accidental unities, the other main type of hylomorphic compound that Aquinas recognizes. As the case of accidental unities, or my diagram of accidental unities, makes clear, substances themselves can serve as the matter for forms or properties, and thereby enter into larger hylomorphic compounds. When a substance, say a lump of bronze, serves as the matter for some form or property, say some shape, it qualifies as matter only in a purely functional sense of the term. For unlike prime matter, it's not a being in pure potentiality, but rather a compound of matter and form, and hence qualifies, as Aquinas sees it, a being in actuality. In order to bring out this contrast with prime matter, I've used a solid line to surround the box containing substance in my diagram. Aquinas often refers to substances, or things that qualify as matter in the purely functional sense, as subjects, subjecta, which we might also translate substrata. Moreover, since the forms or properties for which they serve as the matter or substrata always fall outside their nature or essence, he refers to them as accidental forms or accidents. Interestingly, Aquinas also refers to accidental unities in places as accidents, and presumably the idea is they're complex accidents as opposed to the simple accidents. But I'm just going to follow the practice of calling them accidental unities. Now, as in the case of material substances, Aquinas takes accidental unities to include a number of objects familiar from common sense and experience, including many artifacts. Indeed, one of his favorite examples of an accidental unity is a bronze statue, which he takes to be composed of a material substance and a quality, or more specifically, a lump of bronze and a specific shape. It's important to emphasize, however, that Aquinas also takes accidental unities to include a host of objects that are unfamiliar, if not repugnant to, common sense and experience, including such kooky objects, as the Aristotelian literature calls them, as white Socrates, or pale Socrates, which is an object that comes into existence when Socrates becomes white, say as a result of being kept indoors all winter, and ceases to exist as soon as he acquires a tan. And as it turns out, white Socrates is another of Aquinas' favorite examples of an accidental unity. Finally, it's worth noting that Aquinas is committed to drawing one further distinction with respect to compounds. This is a subdivision of accidental unities. He's committed to distinguishing two different types of accidental unity. And this is because he distinguishes two different types of substance, material and immaterial substances, and insists that substances of both types can serve as the subjects or substrata for accidents. Aquinas doesn't have a special name for these different kinds of accidental unity, but for obvious reasons, I refer to them as material and immaterial unities. And just to give you an example of an immaterial unity, we can take thinking Gabriel. That is, an object that comes into existence when the angel Gabriel comes to have a certain thought that he didn't previously have and ceases to exist when he stops having that same thought. As all of this helps to make clear, even when it comes to the wholly incorporeal or spiritual realm, Aquinas thinks that his hylomorphism has some limited application. For even if angels aren't composed of matter and form, they do serve as the matter or substrata for forms and hence enter into larger compounds. And I've given you a passage under that last diagram on D where Aquinas sort of shows his willingness to speak of matter and form in the case of wholly incorporeal beings, at least if we're using the functional notion of these terms. I've also included on the next page a diagram of the whole world. This is supposed to illustrate the application of hylomorphism to the world as a whole, and also to emphasize that God is the only being that falls outside of the scope of this doctrine. So divine simplicity and aseity requires that God's neither composed of nor enters into any sorts of part-whole relations. Maybe it's worth saying that even though hylomorphism doesn't have application to simple substances, Aquinas will sometimes refer to both angels and God as forms, but I take this to be an analogical use of form. In the primary sense, form is correlative, I think, with both matter and compound, and so this is a different sense. Okay. I guess I wanted to say just a few, let me see how we're doing on time here. I wanted to say a few words that were provoked when I was listening to Professor Gorman's discussion. If you look at my picture and focus on the corporeal, so if you look at the world, the picture of the world under D, and focus just on the corporeal world, you'll see that at least when it comes to Aquinas' hylomorphism there, he does have, as I'm interpreting him, a distinctive sort of substratum theory. Material substances are complexes of substrata and properties, where the substrata are to be understood in terms of matter rather than bare particulars, but there's a similarity to the sort of bare particular theory. But both of these things, the matter or the substrata and forms, are genuine parts or constituents of substances. And I think in that respect, my interpretation of Aquinas differs from Professor Gorman's, though I'm not altogether sure on that point. In any case, it should be clear from my picture that I deny that accidental forms are parts or constituents of substances for Aquinas. On the contrary, I think Aquinas takes them to be parts or constituents only of the larger compounds or accidental unities composed of them. And here I'm pretty confident that that is a difference from Professor Gorman's interpretation. Okay, so to this point, I've been sketching what I take to be the central elements of Aquinas' hylomorphism, in particular his understanding of matter-form composition and his views about which objects exhibit it. But now I want to switch gears. This is the sign that we're moving to stage two and talk about the motivation for Aquinas' hylomorphism. Why does Aquinas hold these views that I've said he does? The short answer I want to suggest is that he thinks they're required by the nature of change. Whoa, almost lost it there. Okay, if you look at the first item under F, you'll see what I think to be the connection between change and hylomorphism. Basically, as I see it, Aquinas thinks that all objects capable of undergoing change, or better, that paradigmatic type of change that he describes in terms of generation and corruption, are hylomorphic compounds, objects composed of matter and form. That's not to say that all objects composed of matter and form are changeable, but the reverse is true. Indeed, change of the relevant type, I think, for Aquinas just is to be analyzed in terms of the generation and corruption of hylomorphic compounds, and so brings this sort of view with it. Obviously, if we want to understand Aquinas' theory of change, we're going to have to get clear about the technical terms in which he frames it, this sort of theory of generation and corruption. And what I want to do is just briefly go over it. I'll start with the notions of generation and corruption. I've actually given you a passage here from De Principiis where he's summarizing the Aristotelian theory of change that I think underlies his hylomorphism. One thing to note, so that first sentence, Aquinas sometimes uses the terms generation and corruption in a narrow sense to apply only to substantial change, but he'll often use it in a broader sense. And even when he does use it in the broader sense, he'll sometimes bring out these differences. So notice that he says, in an unqualified sense, generation and corruption are found only in the category of substance, but in a qualified sense, they're found in other categories as well. And then he goes on to describe generation as a kind of change or mutatio from non-being to being, and corruption as the opposite sort of change from being to non-being. He appeals to the notion of potentiality and actuality, privation, form, and gives us an example of generation and corruption. This is an example of generation or corruption in the qualified sense, as when a statue is generated from a lump of bronze. Okay, so what I want to do is just work through this example briefly to give us some sense of how he's thinking of change. So let's begin with the notions of generation and corruption and with Aquinas' example of a statue that's generated from a lump of bronze. In order to fill out the example, moreover, let's suppose that our lump of bronze starts off being spherical and then at some later point gets melted down and recast in the form of the Greek goddess Athena. In that case, we can say that our example involves both the generation of a statue and the corruption of a sphere. Now, even this simple description, or this simple example, helps us to see that generation and corruption involve the coming to be of one thing as well as the passing away of another. Indeed, I take this just to be the point of Aquinas' saying that generation involves a kind of change from non-being to being, and likewise that corruption involves a kind of change from being to non-being. Commentators sometimes speak as if generation and corruption for Aquinas could straightforwardly be identified with coming to be and passing away, respectively. Indeed, in some cases, they use the English term coming to be and passing away as straightforward translations of the Latin terms generatio and corruptio. But that, I think, is misleading, insofar as it suggests that Aquinas would allow for change to occur regardless of how the termini of change come to be or pass away. To see what's wrong with this suggestion, suppose that the sphere in our example passed away simply because at some point in time God decided to annihilate it, whereas the statue subsequently came into being simply because at some later point in time God decided to create it ex nihilo. In that case, we would have a situation which, for the sake of future reference, we can represent schematically as I have in the diagram at G. Using a circle for our sphere, obviously, a square for our statue, that was the best I could do, and a dotted arrow to represent the direction of time. Okay, so in the case represented by this diagram involving creation and annihilation, we have distinct things coming to be and passing away. In fact, we've got the very same things that are involved in our original example, the coming to be of a statue and the passing away of a sphere. Even so, Aquinas would say, this case does not involve any change or generation and corruption. And that's because, in keeping with common sense, he takes change to require the existence of some being or entity that is changed. And I think you can see this if you look at some of those passages I have under H. So here's one from the Metaphysics. In every change, there must be a subject common to the termini of change. This is a bit more striking in Summa Theologiae Prima Pars. It's part of the very concept or ratio of change that one and the same being is different now from the way it was before. And then finally, a little passage from the De Principiis. In a given change, that which endures or survives is the subject or matter. As these passages make clear, Aquinas thinks that in addition to temporal succession, change requires there to be something that exists throughout the various times presupposed by the succession, a subject that remains numerically one and the same being throughout, and hence may be described as enduring the change or permanent. Indeed, Aquinas explicitly introduces this requirement to distinguish instances of change from instances of creation, as you can see if you look at the rest of that second passage, which I didn't read. And given what Aquinas says about this requirement being built into the very concept of change, I think we can safely assume that he takes it for granted in discussion of changes more generally. There are certain complications associated with the doctrine of transubstantiation, which is a change but doesn't exactly conform to this model, but I'm going to ignore them here. Okay, so in light of all this, we can see that when Aquinas speaks of change in terms of generation and corruption, he doesn't have in mind just any sort of coming to be or passing away. On the contrary, he has in mind very specific types of each, namely those in which one thing comes to be from or passes away into another. Thus, if we want to represent the change involved in the statue example as Aquinas himself understands it, we must introduce some further complexity into the things serving as the termini of change, so as to indicate not only that they involve distinct elements, and hence are themselves distinct, but also that they share a common constituent, and hence overlap. Since Aquinas describes this change in terms of the same bronze having different shapes at different times, we can represent his understanding of the statue example as I have in the diagram at I. Okay, we now have the basic elements of Aquinas' general account of change before us. Change is to be analyzed in terms of the generation and corruption, in terms of generation and corruption, where this is to be understood in terms of the temporal succession of distinct objects that overlap and hence share a common constituent that endures the change itself. It turns out it's a very short step from this general account of change to the basic structure of Aquinas' hylomorphism. That is, that doctrine that for some range of objects, those objects are composed of both matter and form. As those passages at H suggest, Aquinas introduces the term matter for that which remains the same, that is, for the enduring subject of change. In our example, the lump of bronze. By contrast, he introduces the term form for that with respect to which the matter or enduring subject is changed. That is, for something that doesn't endure or remain the same throughout the change. And in our example, this is the different shapes. Finally, he introduces the term compound of matter and form for that which exists in virtue of some matter possessing a form, and hence for what serves as the termini of change. In our example, the sphere and the statue. In short, we can see that Aquinas just analyzes change in general in terms of the generation and corruption of hylomorphic compounds. Okay, I want to say just a few words about this. So there's the basic motivation for the sort of view I've been attributing to Aquinas. I think it follows from all of this that Aquinas is, in an important sense, a realist about matter, form, and hylomorphic compounds. Beings of all three types are required, he thinks, to explain the occurrence of any given change, and yet their relations to one another are such as to require their distinction. Thus, insofar as the matter of any particular change can exist without the forms or compounds with respect to which it changes, it's clear that matter is distinct from both. But it also seems clear that hylomorphic compounds are distinct from both matter and form, whether we take them individually or jointly. For strictly speaking, it is only compounds, not matter or form, that can be generated and corrupted. Indeed, in De Principiis 2, Aquinas insists that to deny this claim would lead directly to an infinite regress. And I've put the passage here. I guess that's under I, but I'm not going to bother to read it. In any case, it should be clear that insofar as matter, form, and compound can be characterized in distinct and incompatible ways, they must be regarded as distinct from one another. And to bring out the sort of realism implicit in Aquinas' general account of change, I've given you a statement of the account at J that's designed to emphasize that, and then tried to spell out the notions of matter, form, and compound that at least approximate the ones I had earlier at K. And as I've indicated there, he's using, at least in this physical context, purely functional notions of matter, form, and compound. So again, matter is just that which survives the change or accounts for the sameness involved in change. Form accounts for the difference. Compounds are what are generated and corrupted. The functional nature of Aquinas' hylomorphism turns out to be important for understanding his full-blown metaphysical views and allows us to introduce some nuance that I said was missing from my earlier discussion. The functional aspect, or the functional nature of his hylomorphism, leaves open the possibility of things of different ontological types playing these different roles. So, for example, both prime matter and substances can play the role of matter. Both properties and subsistent human souls can play the role of forms. And complexes of various kinds can serve as the termini of change or compound. As it turns out, I think, the functional nature of Aquinas' hylomorphism is also important for interpreting some of the other technical notions that he habitually appeals to in his discussions of change, in particular potentiality and actuality, which are crucial for understanding the two different types of change he distinguishes. In fact, as becomes clear early on in De Principiis, these two notions simply provide us with an alternative way of describing the functional roles that Aquinas associates with matter and form. And I think you can see this if you look at that first passage under L. Everything which is in potentiality can be called matter, so too everything through which a being or actuality, whether substantial or accidental, can be called a form. Actually, then he goes on to give us some new examples of change. A human being, talks about a human being becoming white, I guess we've touched on that. Again, sperm and menstrual blood, which is potentially human, becomes actually human through the soul. Okay, and then he connects the notion of soul or form with actuality. So I think matter and form are closely connected with actuality and potentiality. But as we've seen, matter and form are correlative not only to each other, but also to the notion of compound. And interestingly, Aquinas thinks we have to nuance the connection we draw between these three notions and potentiality and actuality if we're going to see this correlativity. And there's this nice passage from his commentary on De Anima that I think brings this out in a clear way. So he says, there's a difference between matter and form. Matter is a being in potentiality, ens in potentia, whereas form is... I don't really know if I've said this out loud very much. Entelechy? that is, an actuality by which matter is actualized. For the same reason, the compound itself is the being in actuality. So strictly speaking, we shouldn't say matter and form are directly associated with potentiality. Actually, matter is associated with a being in potentiality. Form is associated with actuality, and what you get when you get a being in potentiality having the actuality that actualizes it, you get a being in actuality, which is the compound. Okay. In the next... How are we doing on time? We started just a little bit late, so do I have a couple minutes?
7 to 8 minutes.
Okay. So there's the basic account. The rest is just sort of finessing. Basically, the way I understand his view, you've got this general analysis of change that applies to all cases of generation and corruption, but as Aquinas sees it, common sense and experience shows us that there are different types of change or generation and corruption. Some changes involve a pre-existing substance. That's the sort we were talking about with the lump of bronze, changing with respect to one of its accidental or contingent properties. Other changes involve the generation of substances. They don't presuppose the existence of one, but they bring one about. And in M, you get his, he spells this out in terms of the notion of potentiality. Something can be in potentiality with respect to two kinds of being, substantial and accidental. And then we get these examples. The new example here is the one involving a substantial change. I guess we've already touched on it briefly. Here Aquinas tells us human beings are generated from sperm and menstrual blood, or sperm and ova, as we now know. And then he gives the example, this other favorite example of his, the case of a human being, the generation of a white or pale human being. I've also given you a passage here where he goes on to distinguish the different sorts of matter and form, or give names to the different sorts of matter form involved in these different types of change. So in substantial change, again, the matter is primary matter. The form is substantial form. In the other case, it's subject or substratum and accidental form. Okay, I've given you a picture there that illustrates the two examples. There are problems with this depiction. There are certain complications I'm glossing over. The very fact that Aquinas thinks of the case of a human being involve all the examples of change I've been describing are cases of what we might call 1-1 change, where one thing is corrupted and one thing is generated. But Aquinas also allows for cases where many things are corrupted to produce a single thing, or a single thing is corrupted to produce many things. And the case of the generation of a human being is really a case of a many-one change. His favorite example of a one-many change is when you cut a worm in half and end up with two short-lived worms. But I wanted to give you at least one picture where you can see there's a common structure associated with both types of change, and so they both... Both types of change require what we might call functional hylomorphic structure, but different types of entity play the different sorts of matter, form, and compound roles. And I think this is important and not always appreciated by commentators. If what I've said, commentators and critics of Aquinas, if what I've said about Aquinas' views are right, then anytime you have change, there's going to be three distinct beings, matter, form, and compound. And so if there are accidental changes, there must be substances, accidents, and accidental unities. I think Thomistic commentators don't always appreciate that there's a type of compound, some funky weird ones. In fact, the objection people often say is, this is too kooky. White Socrates, standing Socrates, seated Socrates, give me a break. I think Aquinas says, yeah, that is pretty weird, but hey, change, the proper analysis of change requires it, so... suck it up. So I think sometimes Thomistic commentators haven't appreciated the existence of these accidental compounds. Critics of Aquinas, I think, have failed to realize Aquinas' commitment to prime matter. You can't deny, I think, given this analysis of change, that there's something that serves as the substratum. And it's distinct from the other things. Now, there are various puzzles with prime matter. But I think in this case, they seem more puzzling than they really are because people haven't focused on the precise, sophisticated connections between the notions of matter, form, and actuality. So come back, if you look at the very last diagram, here's a kind of hierarchy of compounds in the material world. So we've got a material substance, say Socrates, composed of prime matter and substantial form. He's the subject of an accidental form, say whiteness, and so we've got white Socrates there. Remember these notions. Compounds are beings in actuality, forms are actualities, and matter is a being in potentiality. Well, if you look at how this goes, accidental unities are beings in actuality. They don't serve as substrata for any other forms or compounds, so they don't qualify as beings in potentiality. Material substances, those are beings in potentiality insofar as they serve as substrata for actualities and are parts of larger compounds, but they're also beings in actuality insofar as they're composed of actuality. Now go to prime matter. It's a being in potentiality or pure potentiality. That's a way of saying prime matter is not composed of any matter or form, or more importantly, it's not composed of any actuality. Does that mean it doesn't possess any actuality? No, look, it possesses actuality via inherence. It's the substratum for an actuality. It doesn't possess any actuality in the way in which a material substance does or a compound does. And so I think the claim that prime matter is pure potentiality is not meant to deny that it exists or possesses any actuality. It's a way of saying it doesn't possess actuality in the way a compound does. And I think that helps in some ways to resolve the mystery. I want to close by just making one point. So I've drawn this little thing up here, but I want to connect now some of the things we've talked about with what we talked about before. So maybe this won't work, so I'll just yell. So this is a substance, this is an accident. So it corresponds, they fall under the major division of being that Father Brent introduced us to. Father Brent asked us, are there any things besides God that don't fall under this division of substance and accidents? I suggest there are three: prime matter, substantial form, and accidental unities. Strictly speaking, those don't fall in the categories of substance and accident. Nonetheless, there is a sense in which Aquinas will say they can be traced back to or reduced to. I think we need to be careful with this reduced to talk. They can be traced back to. These are principles of substance, principles of being for substance. Still, they're distinct from this. So there's a way in which they are beings in an analogical sense. So too, accidental unities can be traced back to the category of accidents, since they depend on accidental forms. But still, there's a sense in which if we just talked about material substances and accidents, we'd be missing part of the important ontological commitments of Aquinas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to ask more about the accidental unities. So I definitely understand, talk about white Socrates or shape of bronze. But what about other unities that we might treat with a single name, like events, like eclipse, or something like this, where we have two things which are related, but we don't have this inherence relation. Right, because I think that those are called accidental beings in a way. So what would be the difference between that, since we seem to be able to talk about them in a similar way, at least logically?
Yes. So I describe generation and corruption as the sort of paradigm analysis of change. Not all changes strictly conform to it, but this provides the kind of paradigm against which you're going to... And Aquinas works very hard to say that all these other changes conform to it. Even in the case of transubstantiation, he'll say there's a sense in which there's a substratum because the one substance becomes the other. So I think he's going to try to conform. Basically, that provides, I think the way he's thinking of it, that provides the paradigm for the way we think about change. It gives, and we're tempted to apply that structure to other cases, but sometimes that's misleading. The other day, I think it was Father Brent talking about attributions of blindness. our property attributions are sort of built on this subject-predicate structure, and we're tempted to think they have a property corresponding to them. But when you do the metaphysics and so on, you find out that even if the sort of paradigm gives the structure to our judgment, it doesn't always exactly match the thing being represented. And I would say certain changes are like that. My view is that there are as many accidental unities as there are inherent types of inherent form. And so to solve this, you'd really have to get into the Thomistic dispute about how many distinct types of inherent accident are there.
Thanks, Dr. Brower. I want to see if I could get you and Mike Gorman to agree. And I brought this up in my question to Dr. Gorman yesterday about what's going on with how we are identifying accidental unities with their subjects. And I think part of the reason why you are disagreeing is because you both are accepting a principle that Aquinas rejects, namely that everywhere we have composition, we have parts. So here's a quote from his second quote, Libidals. Therefore, to the first it must be said that sometimes a third thing results from those which are joined together. As the humanity by which a man is constituted from soul and body, so a man is composed of soul and body. Sometimes, however, a third thing does not result from those which are joined together, but a kind of composite intelligible notion results, as when the notions man and white go together to make up the intelligible notion white man. And in such things, something is composed of itself and another. That's a really weird thing to say. Just as a white thing is composed of that which is white and whiteness. And of course, yesterday I also pointed out this is what he thinks is going on with Christ as well. There's composition, but there aren't parts. And this also fits, I think it's important to note, like, this fits well with what Mike Ray says about accidental sameness, right? He thinks... he has this theory, right, that looks like he's identifying the accidental unity in some way with the subject that serves as the matter for the substantial subject that serves as the matter for the unity. I just wanted to throw that your way and see what you think of it. I think this is also tightly connected with how realist Aquinas really is about accidental unities, because he says a lot of things that are very unrealist. He says, accidental things are close to non-being. He says everything that's accidental has to be reduced to what is per se. And I'm wondering if he really is very realist about this, or if, in fact, he thinks there's just a virtual distinction, not a real distinction, between accidental unities and their substantial or substantial matter.
So I think that wasn't a good strategy for getting me to agree with Professor Gorman. But it might be a good strategy to get us to both agree with you. But there were so many things going on in there, I feel like I'm not quite sure where to pick things up. I think what I would prefer to do is just say, I think he's a realist about accidental unities, and here's my challenge to you. Show how it's not entailed by his analysis of change in general or accidental change in particular. I think that's the sort of challenge. There are passages, I think, distributed across his writings. This one you mentioned is one that Therese Corey first called to my attention. That's in the context of being an essence composition. And so it's very complicated.
Are you talking about the composition without part with passage?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Aquinas sometimes uses the notion of composition in a technical or narrow sense. There's this standard practice in medieval philosophy to talk, following Boethius, to talk anytime you can have a division, you can talk about wholes and parts, or composition and parthood. But there are certain kinds of divisions that, I mean, so there, I think it's right that when medievals talk about composition and parthood, they're not always talking about what we mean. And then you had some interesting passages in your paper yesterday where Aquinas will say, well, we can talk about composition without parthood, but really what he just means is we don't really want all that's built into the notion of a part. So I think these are complicated issues, but here's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Aquinas' analysis entails that paradigmatic cases of change require compounds. There are paradigmatic cases of accidental change. Therefore, there are accidental compounds.
And for that, you need not just composition, but parthood. That's your position?
Well, you need something like constituency.
Okay. Thanks.
Professor Barrow, thank you for the talk. I would have a quick question. This reference to matter as being of potency, or prime matter as being of pure potency, so that means to say it's not an unbeing, but it also doesn't have kind of an act of substance. But it seems to have an act of something. So my question is, like, how should we think about a matter like Scotus speaks of it having as an entitative act? It's a kind of entity of some sort. But we understand that it shouldn't be, that Aquinas should have something distinct to those notions, right? The incomplete substance of Suarez or the entitative act of Scotus. But it seems to be a being of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So how should we delineate Aquinas' notion?
So look at the passage under R. Here's what I think the crucial notion for Aquinas is this. Prime matter does not have any form. Let's forget about the privation for a bit. Does not have any form in its nature, or a little later. Look at the next. Let's keep going a bit. Even so, prime matter never exists without a form. Sometimes it exists under one form. Sometimes it exists under another. So it's always a substratum. It always has a form via inherence. But prime matter can never exist through itself. It doesn't have any actuality per se. I think that's a way of saying it doesn't have any actuality in its nature, through itself, as a constituent. So if we identify actuality with form in these contexts, again, look at that picture, the hierarchy of compounds. Suppose I say, do material substances have forms? I think the answer is yes, and they have them in two different ways. They have accidental forms via inherence. They have substantial forms via constituency or composition. Now go to prime matter. Does it have forms? Yeah, but only via inherence. So I think it is a being in actuality in the broad sense, where that just means it has actuality in some way or other. But unlike, say, Scotus or Suarez or some of these later folks, it doesn't have it through itself. It couldn't, in principle, exist by itself. Not even God could create a world that just had some prime matter, because for something to exist, it has to have actuality in some way or other, so he'd have to at least give it actuality by inherence and hence make it part of a compound.
Thank you. I'm troubled a little bit by all your diagrams, which have a section on the passage of time. I wonder whether you think that substantial change involves a passage of time rather than being instantaneous. Thomas is always alert to deny notions of development of substantial form and so forth, which would suggest that substantial change does not involve the passage of time.
Yes, so that's a kind of complication. There's lots of things. My references to time are sort of complicated. It looks like I'm referring to entities that are times. I just want before and after, really. But I do think, and I think you're right, there is a sense in which they're instantaneous, but they're always a part of a process that takes time. So that's what I would want to insist on.
Substantial change itself is instantaneous.
Yes, that seems right.
Hi, thank you. I want to ask about the relationship of form to immaterial substance. Because I'm just a bit, a lot of this is new to me, and so I'm a bit confused about, in the case of the soul, the human soul, that's just the form of the human body, effectively, of matter, rather than a separate immaterial substance, right? That's what I'm getting. But in the case of, like, thinking Gabriel, he's an immaterial substance with an accidental form that's the thinking. So I'm just a bit confused about the relationship there between form and immaterial substance, particularly in the case of the human person.
Yeah, so if you look back at the picture of the world, Gabriel is an immaterial substance. So both Gabriel, suppose that we plug in Gabriel for immaterial substance, Socrates for material substance. Gabriel is an immaterial substance. That's just to say he's not composed of any matter. So strictly speaking, he doesn't have a substantial form, at least in the primary sense. Now, Aquinas will sometimes say, yeah, but Gabriel just is his substantial form. But that's, I think, again, a kind of special use of the term. I think on Aquinas' view, Socrates is composed of his immaterial soul. So he's a material substance. He's material because he's composed of prime matter, but he also has a substantial form, his soul, that he's composed of. That qualifies as immaterial only because it can continue to exist without inhering in any prime matter. So in one sense, it's like Gabriel in that it can exist without matter. But in another sense, it's unlike Gabriel because Gabriel... You know, Gabriel doesn't inhere in anything. I'm not sure if that addresses your question, but...
Yeah, I'm just a bit concerned if their properties are just...
So one thing, yeah, actually, I do want to say, in the case of human beings, you shouldn't think of substantial forms as properties. I don't think a soul, much less a subsistent soul, could be a property. But that's why it's so important to set this within the hylomorphic context, to see that really what a form is in the functional sense... what a form is first and foremost a functional being, a being that stands in a certain relation to matter that's something like property possession. Aquinas thinks of property possession as a kind of dependence. So I do think the soul stands in a relation to prime matter that's something like property. It depends on it, at least for its origin, and then for the exercise of certain of its powers and so on. But I think you're right. You shouldn't think of the human soul as a property. That would be bad.
Thank you, Dr. Bauer. So I know that in De Ente Essentia, he says that I think angelic substances are composed of forming existence. And I was wondering whether you maybe took that into account in your metamorphic treatment. And also, I guess I'm a little concerned about the priority of form. Can you describe it as form inhering in the matter? And it seems kind of bottom up, the condition of like you're kind of building things.
Yes.
Right up to the top. And I guess maybe could you clarify what the priority of form is? My conception of Aquinas' view is that usually it's top-down, or in actuality, informing matter, right? So maybe you could touch on that.
Well, I guess I hold the view that you were saying you were thinking was wrong. I think prime matter and substantial forms are principles of beings of substance, and so they have a kind of priority to the compounds of which they're a part. Now, that's not to say that, I mean, there might be ways in which substances are prior to matter and form, but there's also a sense in which matter and form are prior, on my view, to the compounds. This is part of why Aquinas argues in Prima Pars, in his discussion, I think it's question 3 of Divine Simplicity. He says God can't be composed, can't have any hylomorphic composition, because then he would, if he had any parts or constituents, he would depend on them in the way wholes are dependent on parts, but then he wouldn't be the primary being, so... So I do think there is a sense in which matter and form have priority.
I think this may need to be the last question.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. So, especially for the diagrams. So, I was just wondering, you were talking about the correlative status between body, so matter and form and body. I was wondering if you could talk more about that, especially with respect to the role of disposition of matter or form. This is something I've always been interested in.
What if I just say no? I think maybe I can say something. I'll try to say something very quick. On Brouwer's Aquinas, I think it's clear that Aquinas thinks that at a certain level of composition, human beings or all material substances can be decomposed into prime matter and a single substantial form. And I think in principle, God could put any substantial form in any bit of prime matter that God wanted to, but there's a kind of natural order. Aquinas will say substantial forms are ordered to one another stepwise. And so once you get, say, the form of an element inhering in some prime matter, you get a thing which is in potentiality to taking... Now the prime matter is in potentiality to taking on a thing up the next step. And once you get a an inanimate thing of the right sort, it could become animate. So that, I think that gets... That, something like that, it's going to be done in terms of the forms. Sorry, I was looking at the wrong guy. He was shaking his head, so I was thinking, okay, man, it was okay, thank you very much.
Let's give our thanks to Dr.